Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, Sunday, September 5, 2010, here in WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today we're going to be talking with someone who's arguably the nation's number one progressive radio talk show host and a prolific author, someone who I've been eager to have in the program for a long time, and I'm delighted to get him today. Our guest will be Tom Hartman, host of the Tom Hartman Program on radio across the country. And as I said, an author who is conversant, I think, in the full range of political and media issues. It should be a wonderful hour, so please stay tuned and join us for today's show. But before we go to our guests, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey.
Latinos for Internet Freedom, a new coalition of more than 40 organizations and groups, launched last week to advocate for an open and accessible Internet. With 47 million people, Latinos are the largest community of color in the United States. Amalia Deloney of the Center for Media Justice says that the organizations who make up the coalition have come together to ensure that Latinos have a say in Internet policymaking.
They all have a deep commitment to being of service and working with Latino communities. And so they represent the voices of real Latinos in the community, not community members who are on the payroll of a telco, not high-powered lobbyists who are inside the Beltway. These are average folks that we grew up with, that we work with, that live in the neighborhoods that we come from, who work on issues that have a profound impact on the health and well-being of Latino communities. And all of these organizations are saying, in addition to all of the other things that we're engaged in, we absolutely want to say that we want an open Internet.
The key partners of Latinos for Internet Freedom are Presente and the Center for Media Justice.
We have organizations from New Mexico like Media Literacy Project and San Antonio Esperanza Peace and Justice Center and the Media Justice League, folks like People's Production House in New York, Main Street Project in Minnesota, organizations of all different sizes with a range of issues that they're committed to.
Deloney says that for Latinos, the Internet is mediating many aspects of life. The Internet has become the place to go for regulating immigration status, accessing health care information, finding after-school programs for kids or English language classes, and even searching for jobs.
All of those things, are important to Latinos and are part of having an open Internet. But I think more crucial is the fact that it's the primary advocacy and organizing tool that we're using. You know, whether it's the pushback on SB 1070 in Arizona, whether it's the work that's done after immigration raids in communities, whether it's just the national advocacy we're doing on other issues like education and healthcare, like everybody else, we're using the Internet to connect to one another. We're using the Internet to connect and share stories with our families, wherever they may be. And we need to know that the experience that we have online is not discriminated against by our Internet service provider.
For more information, go to latinonetlibre.com.
Bloggers beware. A company in Las Vegas is scouring the Internet for copyright infringement and filing lawsuits against websites that host Las Vegas Review Journal articles. Righthaven has filed nearly 100 lawsuits against small bloggers, nonprofits, and political and community organizations for purportedly violating copyright law. The company has sued people for anything from sharing entire articles to linking to an attributed article to hosting a forum where readers include links to articles and comment sections. Cindy Cohn, legal director for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, said her organization is troubled by what appears to be a, quote, lawsuit mill.
It appears that this is a business model, that they're just bringing a whole lot of copyright lawsuits and figuring that they can shake down enough money from enough people to make themselves a tidy profit.
Righthaven demands thousands of dollars and scares people into settling out of court, even if their cases could fall under fair use. Cohn said that Righthaven's sweep is particularly shocking because the company is not following the traditional protocol of simply notifying websites to take down questionable content.
They're basically suing people first. They're not you know, they're not sending any cease and desist notices. They're not giving any notice whatsoever. They're basically suing first and asking questions later. To me, it really reflects the fact that this is a business proposition for them and not really people who care about copyright infringement.
And the business proposition appears to be growing. Another newspaper chain in Arkansas, WEHCO Media, which controls 28 papers in the state, has become a Right Haven client. The practice has people wondering if newspapers will increasingly turn to small copyright lawsuits to bolster waning profits.
I understand that the powers that be in journalism are very concerned because their business model doesn't work very well in an era of Craigslist and classified ads for free. But, you know, the idea that suing the audience is the answer here, and in this instance, suing the small bloggers who are simply trying to draw attention to the work that you've done, you know, many of them, is going to save the journalism. I just don't think anybody who seriously thinks about the future of journalism thinks that this is the answer. I think that's what the lawyers are telling people in order to try to make it look like they're not doing what they're doing.
Cohn said that bloggers and websites should research fair use guidelines to help protect themselves and make sure they are reposting content properly. To find out more information, visit www.eff.org.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today in WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Our guest today is one of the leading progressive radio talk show host in the United States, Tom Hartmann. There's a show that can be heard all over the country, or you can hear it by going to his website, tomhartmann.com, and you can get it there. And he's also a prolific author on a number of subjects we'll be talking about today. And I think we've rarely had a guest as conversant in the whole full range of media and political issues as our guest, Tom Hartmann. Tom, welcome to Media Matters.
Hi, Bob. It's a pleasure and an honor to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's an honor for us to have you on the airwaves here in Central Illinois. And I wanted to have you on this weekend, Tom, because this is Labor Day weekend. And tomorrow, of course, being Labor Day. And your work, I think, as much as anyone, and on your program, discuss the state of working class or middle class America, the state of our economy, the state of our political system related to our economy. And I thought you'd be the ideal guest. Let's just start with your overview. What is the state of the economy for working class and middle class Americans as we approach Labor Day 2010?
Well, it's a disaster, and it's been a train wreck ever since the introduction of Reaganomics, although the last couple of years of the Carter administration, as he was starting to adopt some of Maggie Thatcher's policies in the late 70s, didn't help. And Bill Clinton with NAFTA and GATT have made the situation far worse. But basically, you know, we've got, I took the train recently from New York to D.C., and all along the route, there's all these empty factories, you know, just boarded up, busted out windows. That's the state of America. We've lost our manufacturing. And without that, I mean, we've gone, you know, when Reagan was elected president, a third of our GDP came from manufacturing. Now it's 11%. No country that has had their manufacturing drop below 15% has remained any kind of a industrial power for more than a generation.
Now, there are going to be people who argue, and I suspect you've heard these arguments, that, well, that's because American wages are so high and businesses seek out lower wages. Does that argument hold water?
No, it's nonsense. It's just plain old flat-out nonsense. You know, one of my favorite stories, Bob, from the founding of our nation was, and one that most people don't know, is that on April 14th in 1789, as I recall, George Washington was at Mount Vernon, just out walking through his fields, and Charles Thompson, who was the Secretary of the Continental Congress, rode up on horseback and said, "Mr. President, or General Washington, you have been just elected president of the United States." Continental Congress was meeting, I don't recall if it was Philadelphia or New York City. And Washington had 2 weeks to show up for the inauguration. And he had, and so he made a, there were two things he wanted to do. One was to say goodbye to his 82-year-old mother, which he did. She died a few months later. And the second was he wanted to get an American-made suit. At that time, nobody was manufacturing clothing in the United States. The British, you know, were basically controlled trade in the United States. And there was this one guy, Daniel Hinsdale, in Hartford, Connecticut, who had started a high-quality clothing company in defiance of the British laws. He started in 1783 in Hartford. And so George Washington sends a courier to Henry Knox, his old friend and fellow general from the American Revolutionary War. And Henry Knox hops on his horseback and rides to Hartford, Connecticut, to get an American-made suit that George Washington can be wearing when he's sworn in as president. It was a brown silk and wool suit made entirely in America by Americans. Some of the silk wasn't American. It was imported, but it's almost 100% American suit. And then, you know, for the famous photograph, he's wearing black. That was British made, of course, later on. But he wanted to be sworn in. He wanted to raise his hand wearing an American suit. That was 1789. In a couple of years later, 1791, he went to his Treasury Secretary, Alexander Hamilton, and said, "What can we do about the fact that we're basically this little backwater country? We don't make anything here. We're importing everything from England. We're basically a very poor country. What do we do?" And Hamilton came forward with what he called his report on manufacturers. So it took him about a year to write it. He submitted it to Congress and in 1791. And by 1793, almost all of the 11 steps in it had been implemented either by law or by Washington executive orders. And what they did was put into place protective tariffs, that, in other words, import taxes, to protect American industry and subsidies for American industry and protections for development in American industry and outright subsidies for R&D in American industry and a ban on the export of raw materials that could be used for manufacturing in other countries. And that plan, which, by the way, was based on what was called the Tudor Plan that was put together by Henry VII in 1485, which turned England from a backwater, you know, their major export in 1485 was wool, turned them into a major industrial power. He based it on that. That plan stood in the United States until the late 1970s, early 1980s. In fact, from the founding of the Republic until the Civil War, 100% of the cost of federal government, the salary of every single legislator, the president, 100% of the cost was paid for with tariffs. From the Civil War to World War I, two-thirds of the total cost of government in the United States was paid for by import tariffs. And from World War I to World War II, a third was paid for by tariffs. And then, of course, the government grew much larger, and we started having income taxes and other things. But and right up until the 1980s, or the late 70s, our average tariff in the United States, import tariff, from 1791 until the late 70s, was in the neighborhood of 30%. There was a range of fluctuation over the years in the high 20s to the low 40s, but it averaged around 30-35%. And that protected American industry. And then we went insane. We started drinking this so-called free trade Kool-Aid, which was just basically big corporations saying, you know, we want to control the show. And now we're in a situation where half of what we call trade, international trade in the United States, is actually intra-company. It's Hewlett-Packard U.S. buying printers from Hewlett-Packard China. And that's not trade. That's the arbitrage of labor. But no American media, major media, will talk about this. And the reason why is because these corporations are all doing this. You know, the guy who brags about the fact that he invented outsourcing of white-collar and pink-collar jobs, Jack Welch, was the CEO of GE, which owns NBC. So,
our guest, Tom Hartman, you've been listening to This is Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580. Tom Hartman, the host of the Tom Hartman program, which can be heard noon to 3 o'clock Eastern time, hundreds of stations across the country. You can go to his website, tomhartman.com, to see if you find the station nearest to you or to pick it up on the Internet. Tom spelled with an H, Hartman with two N's at the end. The lines are open today at will if you want to call in and speak with our guests. The number here, 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. As I said at the outset, this is a show where I think any topic of economics, politics, or media is fair game. Feel free to call in with your questions or comments. Tom, are there countries in Europe or elsewhere in the world, for that matter, anywhere in the world, where they've got industrial policies protecting good-paying manufacturing jobs that you'd like to see the United States emulate?
Yeah, well, let me give you a couple of examples. Ha-Joon Chang is a South Korean economist who is a professor at Oxford, and he wrote a book called Bad Samaritans, The Myth of Free Trade and the Secret History of Capitalism, which is a major economic book, and it's a brilliant book, in 2008. And he points out that in 1961, South Korea had the same $82 per capita annual income that Kenya does. Now, just 6 months ago or so, our president went it was longer than that, when he was in Kenya, and he said, this country, look at what South Korea did. You guys have to bring yourselves up. Well, South Korea in 61 had the same average per capita income as Kenya does right now. And their main exports were fish and human hair for wigs. And so what happened was, in 61, General Park Chung-hee took Alexander Hamilton's plan and said, we're going to do this. He instituted what he called the Heavy and Chemical and Industrial Program. He built modern steel mills and a shipyard. South Korea began producing their own cars. Their import tariff on imported cars went up to 100%. Their imported tariffs on most other products went up to 50 or 70%. And between 1972 and 1979, the per capita income of that country grew five times, 500%, in less than a decade. And they continue, by the way, to have import bans, high tariffs, excise taxes, as does Japan. And they've built these, massive industries. In fact, Samsung is the largest conglomerate in the world. Yeah.
Kaibol, I think they call it. Yeah.
Yeah. $173 billion in revenue in 2008. And it was entirely created by the government backing up. Same thing with Japan. Japan didn't do it in 61. Japan did it in the 50s. But they basically took Hamilton's plan and said, we're going to do this. And, in fact, in Japan in the early 50s, the annual per capita income was under $500. And now Japan is, both Japan and South Korea have a higher quality of life than we do in the United States when you look at things like, lifespan, longevity, ability to get a job, access to health care, et cetera.
Well, in the United States, we have two political parties, one of which proudly proclaims it's the party of business, and the other one claims to be the party of everyone else, at least at election time when it wants votes. And how good a job is the Democratic Party doing of promoting the sort of policies you're talking about?
Well, miserably. First of all, they won't even acknowledge them. they literally won't even acknowledge them. I was invited to a meeting at the White House with one of the senior economists there about 6 months ago, just a small group of reporters, and in one of these little conference rooms downstairs in the West Wing. And this guy went through this whole pitch about the Economic Recovery Act, and we just spent $787 billion, and we saved 3 million jobs, and is this wonderful? And I just, and I said, when are you going to repudiate this free trade insanity and start having a national industrial policy and a trade policy that is of America and for Americans, like most other countries do? Germany does, for example. And he basically said, next question. We're not going to go there.
One of the things that has come out, and I know this is something you're familiar with and aware of, is that over the course of the Obama administration, especially I'd say in the last year, there's been somewhat frosty relations between the administration and what it has termed the professional left, meaning those...
Just you and me.
and also those journalists and reporters and pundits who are not seen as being sufficiently with the program when the Obama administration is under attack. How did you respond when you first heard that, and what is your sense of, the Obama administration?
I was, during the election, I was an enthusiastic supporter of Barack Obama, but I also made it very clear repeatedly that his campaign was very vague and that I thought he was a national Rorschach test. I thought that the people, the hysterics on the right and the racists on the right and the, fill in the blank on the right, they were seen in that ink blot of his vagueness. They were seeing the most horrible things they could imagine, and progressives like myself were seeing the most positive things we could imagine. And the reality was that he'd probably come out kind of in the middle. we thought, many of us, many progressives thought that we had elected FDR, you know, a man with great oratorical skills who would take on the established power structure, the economic royalists, as FDR called them. And it turns out that we got Bill Clinton. And frankly, not even a particularly good Bill Clinton, more like Jimmy Carter in terms of communication skills, but Bill Clinton in terms of economic policy. And it's a tragedy. He has the bully pulpit. He could be taking names and kicking butt. But instead, I've often said, I wish Doris Kearns Goodwin had gone into writing fiction instead of nonfiction. Because had he not read, you know, that, what was the title of her book?
Oh, the Lincoln Book?
Yeah, yeah. Team of Rivals, I think
mm-hmm,
it was.
Mm-hmm.
About how Lincoln brought all the people who hated him into his cabinet, and Obama was like, I'm going to do that. You know, let's get Judd Gregg in here as Commerce Secretary. You know, I mean, that's insanity, right? And for almost two years now, he's been trying to prove that he can be postpartisan, and it's like trying to prove that a carrot came off an apple tree.
Do you think that the Democrats are going to get clobbered in November?
Yeah, I do, and frankly, they deserve to, given the performance, the communications performance this White House has done. A lot of good stuff has been done, and certainly a hell of a lot of good stuff came out of the House of Representatives. Nancy Pelosi and the Progressive Caucus in the House have done a spectacular job. The Senate has killed so many of those things. And I would say a large proportion of them, if President Obama had wanted to really speak out loud and get aggressive, it could have changed. But, you know, in his first 12 months in office, he mentioned the word or the phrase George W. Bush zero times, never once. He needed to have, you know, the American people, now this is his bad economy. The American people, by and large, have forgotten who caused these problems, and in at least the most recent version of them. They've forgotten how deregulation led to this, and they have no idea that for 170 years we had a national industrial policy that built us into a first world nation, and that when we stripped that away, we're rapidly descending into third world status.
You know, along those lines, Tom Hartman, I recall during the Reagan years and even into the first Bush's presidency, all economic problems and all foreign policy problems were automatically attributed to Jimmy Carter.
Right.
Any bad news for 10 years after Jimmy Carter left office was always his fault. I mean,
right.
You would have thought he was still president half the time.
Well, and the same thing with Bill Clinton. You know, in the first year, I mean, before 9/11, that Bill Clinton was George W. Bush, or at least his proxies, you know, favorite whipping boy. And, you know, then, of course, 9/11 happened, and George got to become Superman. He created Lex Luthor. He turned Bin Laden into Lex Luthor, but that's a whole other story.
Well, yeah. It seems that if you look at what's happening politically in the United States, the Democrats, and I think progressives, won decisive national elections in 2006 and 2008. And what do they have actually to show for it, I mean, that they can take before the American people?
Well, unfortunately, it almost doesn't matter, Bob, because with unemployment as high as it is and underemployment so dramatically higher because we've lost our manufacturing base, the average American, you know, you could talk all day long about the Lilly Ledbetter Act or, you know, the nice stuff around the margins, but it doesn't matter if you don't have a good job, you can't make your mortgage, and you can't put your kids through college. And that's, or if you're a student, you're going to graduate $50,000, $100,000 in debt. And that's what people are looking at, and that's what this administration should have been focused like a laser on for 2 years, and instead they basically dithered.
Yeah, what's going to happen come November, Tom Hartman, after the election, assuming, as you project, that the Republicans will win decisive victories in the congressional races, when the conventional wisdom is going to be, well, this proves Obama was waved too far to the left, and he needs now to play ball with the Republicans and be a centrist. On a scale of 1 to 1 billion, with 1 billion being the highest, how incensed are you going to be at this conventional wisdom?
Oh, Bob. It's insanity. It's frankly insanity. Who's the New York Times? Paul Krugman wrote a column about that last week. You know, that the stimulus, there was a $2.9 trillion hole that was kicked in our economy by basically Phil Graham, you know, in 99 and 2000 with the blowing up the Glass-Steagall Act and with the Commodity Futures Modernization Act that led to the bubble of the first decade of century that led to the crash of 2008. And Obama tried to fill that $2.9 billion hole with an $800 billion bill that was a couple hundred billion of it was tax cuts, which don't do anything at all. And so, you know, and just like with healthcare, I mean, and so many other things, the response to real and urgent and large problems has been small, mediocre, and tepid. And so, yeah, I think the not only are the right going to be saying this repudiates Keynesianism and it repudiates, you know, Obama's economic policies, but frankly, I think that the corporate media is going to, too, because, you know, they're mostly run and owned by billionaires, and they're looking for their tax cuts, and increasingly we're just becoming an oligarchy in this country.
Our guest today on Media Matters, Tom Hartman. You've just been listening to, host of the Tom Hartman Program on radio across the country, author of numerous books, and we've alluded to a couple of them already on the economy and on corporate power. We'll talk more about them in the second half of the show. If you'd like to call in with questions or comments to Media Matters, the number here, 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. And then, of course, Tom Hartman, there's the matter of war and empire and militarism. And Barack Obama, I think it's fair to say, got the nomination from Hillary Clinton to no small extent because he, of the two then, the distinguishing feature was he had opposed the Iraq war invasion before, you know, before the war, unlike Hillary Clinton. And that was enough to convince a lot of progressives that he was probably someone closer to their taste.
Right.
What do you make of his foreign policy since coming to office?
I'm suspending judgment on it for a few moments, which makes my listeners crazy, but or some of them. but this guy was handed not just a disaster; he was handed, you know, a whirling dervish, a Tasmanian devil, and you know on speed. He was handed a screaming, bloody, literally disaster, and there is no easy way out. And if he had gotten out very quickly from both Iraq and Afghanistan, there would be, and there will be, and there is, in fact, ongoing anyway, a bloodbath, probably not as bad as Vietnam, but it would be. And the Republicans would blame him for, quote, losing those wars and losing those countries, end quote. So he's got to figure out a way to back out in a way that is relatively safe for our people and minimizes the damage to those countries, which has already been massive, and lets him declare victory. You know, he's got to do what the former senator from Vermont, I forget his name, suggested to LBJ. You know, he said, why don't you just leave Vietnam and declare victory?
You know, but at the same time, Tom, we're at a moment economically where we're not a boom economy like we were in the 1960s, say, in right. where devoting $1 trillion or whatever it is annually of our budget to militarism and war, there's a real cost on the domestic front, isn't there?
It's huge. And what Reagan did and what George W. Bush did, by and large, was they propped up the economy by military spending. And you know, that's the problem with military spending, the problem with spending, you know, $2 or $3 or $4 trillion, which, you know, arguably as much as $6 trillion has been spent since Reagan on military beyond, you know, what we would normally need just to have a military, but on foreign wars and on Star Wars, you know, Iraq, Afghanistan, and Reagan's Star War program. The problem with that is that when you take $1 trillion and you use it to build bombs and you go over to some country and you drop those bombs, that $1 trillion is gone. On the other hand, if you take $1 trillion and you build schools and hospitals and bridges and roads and high-speed rail, you've created $2 trillion or $3 trillion worth of tax revenues from increased economic activity over the next 5 decades. And you know, we saw this very clearly in the rebuilding of America in the United States. Throughout the construction of America, using, you know, Alexander Hamilton's program, you know, right up until the 80s, and then Reagan just pulled the plug on all that stuff. We haven't basically done anything to our infrastructure since Reagan became president, and it's a screaming disaster, Bob.
And do you see any indication that the Obama administration right now is leaning towards, you know, making that sort of investment in infrastructure that you just called for?
I think they have no choice. This is now, because they're not willing to look at national industrial policy or trade policy, this is the only way they can stimulate the U.S. economy. we're already running full tilt boogie on manufacturing military stuff. We manufacture a third of the weapons sold in the entire planet, and that's not enough to stimulate the economy. The problem with the stimulus bill was that, you know, $500-600 billion got dumped into the hands of consumers. They bought things, but the problem is they bought things that were made in China. You know, they went down to Walmart and bought things. So we stimulated the Chinese. You know, arguably three-quarters of that entire stimulus went right to China. And so if he wants to keep money circulating in the domestic economy, at least over the short term, then it has to be in bricks and mortar here in the United States, because that can't be outsourced to China. And so I predict that between now and the election, you're going to see a huge uptick in that, because he's got to get people back to work. And whether he can do, you know, what he can do by executive order, what he still has in the bag from money that's been appropriated by Congress and not spent, I don't frankly know. But, without a change in our trade policy, which I think is essential, and as, you know, we've talked about, the big corporate media in America doesn't want to talk about, because they're all making money on offshore trade. But without a change in trade policy, the only thing he's got is the short-term stimulus. And even that's not going to be any kind of long-term solution.
Our guest, Tom Hartman. This is Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, on WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Phone lines open at 333-9455 or toll-free 1-800-222-9455. We have a couple callers who have been waiting patiently. Let's go to the phone lines right now, starting with line one, Champagne. You're on the air with Tom Hartman.
Okay. Can you hear me okay?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. I have kind of something of a comment and a question. During the Great Depression, FDR essentially developed our social safety net, Social Security, unemployment, and so forth. I would find it ironic if, and let's say agree with Krugman, that this is something of another depression, that there will be something of a successful assault on that social safety net if Congress goes in a certain direction come this fall. And I'm curious how successful you think that may be. Two, what's your impression on the same sort of assault on Europe's social safety net, particularly though England's not part of Europe, but particularly what Cameron, what's his name, Cameron is doing
there? Yeah, Cameron, that's right.
And I'll just hang up and listen. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, caller. And if I can add to that question for you, Tom Hartman, on the terms of the attack on the social safety net, specifically, there's one of these, you know, so-called bipartisan commissions that's going to come up with ways to cut Social Security and possibly Medicare and make it so there's no political accountability for the cuts. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's particularly tragic because, ironically, that commission is supposed to be reducing the budget deficit in the United States, and Social Security has no role whatsoever to play in the budget deficit because it's separate from the budget. It's got its own separate accounting system. So this looks to me, you know, Wall Street was one of the largest supporters of President Obama when he was running in 2008, and now more than 50% of their money is going to Republicans. I frankly think that this might be his way of trying to get that money back. We're seeing the awful and pernicious influence of money on politics in America. The reality is that with the Citizens United decision in January, a Supreme Court decision that said that corporations are people and have First Amendment rights and can carpet bomb anybody with any advertising they want in an election. I mean, there's some restrictions, but not meaningful. A lot of politicians are trembling in fear. You know, you've got corporate groups that have already committed $400 million just to these elections coming up in November. And Karl Rove's group has already raised $52 million, and 90% of that came from four billionaires. So I'm concerned that you've got a $2.5 trillion trust fund that Social Security has that right now is invested in nice, safe treasuries that are returning a, you know, 1.5%, 2% yield. Nothing great, but it's safe, it's there, and it'll be there. And Wall Street is drooling to get its hand on that money, because if they can skim 0.5% off the top of $2.5 trillion every year, they're going to do really well. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very concerned about that. In terms of tearing apart the social safety net, that's something that's been going on for a long time. Again, going back to Reagan, I mean, you know, Reagan was the first openly anti-labor president, but he was also the first openly anti-New Deal. I mean, the Reagan Revolution really and truly was a revolution. There was a fundamental change in America's view of itself. We went from being from the Great Depression, from 1928 until 1980, we were a we society. People pitched in, people looked out for each other, people felt that the commons were important, that the government was us, and it was us helping us, and we were here for each other. We went from being a we society to being a me society, with this bizarre Ayn Rand libertarian objectivist notion that if everybody acts selfishly, that the combined selfishness of everybody will produce a social good. It's not true, doesn't work, never has worked in any country where it's been tried. Anybody who really thinks libertarianism works should move to the libertarian paradise of Somalia, where, you know, very small government, no regulations on industry. And that's the direction that we've been moving in for 30 years, Bob, and to the caller. I think ironic is not a strong enough word for if this depression and the failure to aggressively respond to it by the Obama administration, if this depression is used as the lever, as it uses the fulcrum point to pry out more pieces of it. And by the way, it wasn't just FDR. You know, LBJ cut poverty in half in the United States in 4 years with the Great Society. Had he not been embroiled in the Vietnam War, I think he would be remembered as one of our greatest presidents, or one of our greater Democratic presidents. Mm-hmm. He accomplished amazing things. And yet, you know, I was out in the streets getting tear gassed protesting LBJ. I hated him because he was killing my friends.
Yeah, the second half, Tom, of the caller's question referred to what's going on, similar problems in Europe, or similar situation where economic slowdown, severe fiscal crises of governments. And if I can add to that, too, it seems that in countries like Greece or France, and there are others as well, that when they start doing serious slashing of social programs, you turn around, there's 500,000 people in the streets of Athens or Paris closing down the government. Is that ever going to happen in this country?
It won't happen now because we don't have any organizing systems for it. When Reagan came into office, 25% of our workforce was unionized. We hit the peak in 47 when Taft-Hartley was passed. We had 35% unionization. We're now down to 7.5-8% of the private workforce being unionized in the United States. So there's just not the power to bring them out. Secondly, you've got the media ignoring things. I mean, you know, a couple of months ago you had the U.S. Social Forum in Detroit. 20,000 progressive activists came together to meet and talk over 5 days, and actually marched from Cobo Hall down to the Wren Center or whatever it was. Anyhow, long march in Detroit. And the only television network to show up and document that and report on it was the one that carries my show and Amy Goodman and Laura Flanders, Free Speech TV Network, which is on the two satellite systems mm-hmm. in the country, but not on most cable systems. And so it's like everybody, you know, but 300 Tea Partiers show up, and you've got, you know, every satellite truck within the state has been rented, so by the networks. So there's this incredible bias in the media that you, Bob, have done such a brilliant job reporting on over the years, and that's going to make it that plus the pernicious influence of money, which has been amplified 100-fold with the Citizens United ruling and the knocking down of McCain-Feingold, is going to make it so much more difficult. And then on top of that, just to finish the last thought, I'm afraid that Obama, if he doesn't handle Afghanistan right, is going to end up like LBJ with Vietnam, and he's got to figure that one out. And I wish him well. I wouldn't. It's going to be a tough one.
Our guest, Tom Hartman. This is Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Phone lines open at 333-9455 or toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to our phone lines now to line 4, Peoria. You're on the air with Tom Hartman, and thank you for your patience.
Hi. I'm going to make a comment. The final nail in the coffin of our economy for me, and I worked in manufacturing for 30 years in factories here in Peoria, was when I saw this, I think it was Rick Santelli. Is that the guy?
Yeah.
And he, about a year or so ago, and he was yelling at the camera.
We need a tea party.
Pardon me?
That was a setup. When he yelled, "We need a tea party," that was a setup, by the way. That thing was all planned and staged.
What I remember, isn't he a financial guy or something?
Yeah. Yeah, he's a Wall Street guy.
What I remember was he turned around and there was a room full of traders, and he said, "This is America." He was addressing Obama. He said, "This is America. these are the workers of America who don't want to bail out lazy people who made bad loans or who took bad loans. And for me, you know, I thought we've finally hit the bottom because that
is, you're talking to a room full of millionaires.
Who don't produce anything. You don't add value to anything.
They're gamblers.
Yeah, right. And, okay, that's my comment.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Do you want anything you want to add to that, Tom Hartman?
Yeah, I'd just like to put a punctuation point on the last one, the comment about Europe. Harry Truman, you know, in 47, when Taft-Hartley was passed, which rolled back the protections, many of the protections of the Wagner Act of 1935 for organized labor and created right-to-work states and things. Harry Truman was trying to encourage more unionization in the United States. Instead, he got his teeth kicked in when Republicans took control of Congress in the election of 46. So he helped the Germans write their constitution in, you know, defeat, and wrote into the German constitution that every corporation in Germany has to have 50% of its board of directors made up of representatives of organized labor who work in that corporation. And that's why when Germany was hit actually harder than we were by the recession of 2008, that they didn't have – their unemployment numbers didn't go up because they went to what they called Kurzarbeit, short week, short work. And workers took a day off, and then the government kicked in and paid it through the companies, kicked in the makeup, you know, to make up the salary to almost a full paycheck, and then the companies paid that along to the employees. And so there was never a loss of demand in Germany. And unions are very strong in that country and always will be because they're in the it's in the Constitution. And this is why, you know, Europe, I think, by and large, you're gonna have swings left and right. Sarkozy's gonna do his best. He thinks he's George Bush, but frankly, continental Europe is, I think, always going to be solidly union and progressive and relatively safe socially. England is a whole different thing. You know, they were infected by Maggie Thatcher in 1978, and they haven't recovered from it, just like we were infected by Ronald Reagan.
Tom Hartman, this Ground Zero mosque story of the last couple weeks or few weeks, there's a lot to talk about there. But one thing that struck me in the coverage of the story and the way it came about and took place was the Republican Party, which has been sort of a Reaganite, neoliberal, whatever term you want to use, party for the last few decades. It seems that it's even taken another turn, and not a very good one, in the past few years. And this Ground Zero episode brings it to light in the sense that, you know, George W. Bush, for all his criticism people made of him, at least was clear not to blame Islam per se for 9/11 or for terrorism. And, you know, it was very strong in that statement. And it seemed like that voice, except for Ron Paul and one or two other people who are on the distant margins of the Republican Party, was all but absent during the Ground Zero mosque, during this controversy. And this is a long way of saying, is the Republican Party, I mean, what's happening there? And it seems that the Democratic Party has been following in the wake of the Republican Party for the last three decades, moving right after it. Are we going to very dangerous places with our political culture in this country?
Yeah, we are, Bob. And we're seeing, I mean, Newt Gingrich being basically a traitor. He's out there promoting the interests of Osama bin Laden and the radicals within Islam. Tim McVeigh, when he blew up the federal building, was following the Turner Diaries, this novel about how a valiant, WASP, pro-gun, right-wing, white guy American blows up a federal building in Oklahoma City, and the government clamps down so hard and takes away everybody's guns that there's a rebellion, and all the color people of color and all the Jews and all the liberals are murdered, and in the end there's just good white Protestants standing with their guns, right? And that's what Tim McVeigh thought he was going to do. He was going to create a government blowback against gun owners and against the right that would cause a revolution in America. Well, Bill Clinton didn't give him that and didn't turn him into a hero in the eyes of the right. Osama bin Laden told us in 1998 he was going to try and do the same thing. It's published in the New York Times. And that, you know, an overreaction by our government would cause us to bleed to death. And George Bush did exactly what he wanted, and now Newt Gingrich is doing exactly what he wants, you know, causing the, you know, 1.5 billion people in the world to think that we're nuts. And then you got this guy down in Florida who's going to burn Korans, and today in Indonesia they were having demonstrations. I mean, it's the Republican Party's gone insane. They've just gone insane. And one of the things that's fueling it are these a few cranky billionaires who are just pumping more and more and more money into these phony populist groups that get people all worked up about non-issues so that they're not paying attention to what's really going on, and so that they go along with simple slogans like, you know, taxed enough already, TEA, when really it's just the billionaires who want the tax cuts, you know.
We've got a full bank of callers waiting to speak with our guest, Tom Hartman, today on Media Matters. So let's go to the phone lines now. We'll make sure we get to all of you before the show ends, starting with line one, Champagne. You're on the air with Tom Hartman.
Hi, Tom. It's an honor talking with you. I'm a listener of your radio program. I'm a full believer in the idea that it is the money in our political system that is the real fundamental basic corrupter. Mm-hmm. But I don't have a solution for how to get money out of our political system and still preserve the basic freedom of speech so that anyone could say anything they want. I'd like to hear your ideas on that.
Sure. McCain-Feingold, I think, went a long way in that. Until the Supreme Court knocked down that provision in 2008, it outlawed basically what Carly Fiorina and Meg Whitman are doing, rich people buying their own campaigns and put limits on their own internal contributions. And if we were to just go back into the 14th Amendment, I wrote a book about this called Unequal Protection, The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights, or How Corporations Became People. If we were just to go back into the 14th Amendment and insert the word natural before the word person, it would blow up 38 Supreme Court rulings that have progressively over the last 130 years or so given more and more rights under the Constitution to corporations, which are not people and shouldn't have those rights. Real straightforward stuff.
Let's go to our next caller now, who's been waiting patiently. Ottawa, Illinois, line two, you're on the air with Tom Hartman.
Thank you. I was just going to call and ask your comments on the growing deficits in this country that I guess they're projecting the next one to be $1.3 trillion. And combined with trade deficits, where we're basically borrowing money from China to buy Chinese goods or to fight in Afghanistan to keep one soldier over there is $1.2 million, I guess, and a year. And I just like your comments. I mean, what's the future of the United States in 10 or 20 years, owing trillions of dollars and having no way to pay people's pensions or Social Security? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Tom Hartman?
Well, first of all, Social Security has nothing to do with those budgets and deficits, and Social Security is going to be solvent for almost 30 years, and if we just lifted the cap so that Bill Gates paid the same Social Security tax rate that you and I do, Social Security would be able to increase their payments by 50% right now and go back to where they were when Reagan came into office. That is a payment that's really practically enough for a person to live on in retirement and be solvent forever. So don't worry about Social Security. In terms of deficits, there's two different deficits, and they have two completely different impacts in America. Our budget deficit, if it was a problem, would be driving up the price of borrowing money. In other words, it would be driving up interest rates, and it's not. Right now, our treasuries are selling for, or are offering a, you know, less than a 2% return, even long-term treasuries. And so that means that the rest of the world doesn't give a whit about our deficit. That's not a problem because we're the world's reserve currency. And as long as we are, we can sustain a budget deficit much larger. Our deficit at the end of World War II is 110% of GDP. We've been there before and far worse than now. But back in 73, a Republican strategist by the name of Jude Waninsky came up with this thing called the two Santa Claus theory, where he said, when Republicans are in office, borrow like crazy, spend like crazy, run the deficit up. When Democrats come into office, everybody, like a chorus, including the Republicans and the media, scream about the budget deficit and get hysterical and get people whipped up about it so that the Democrats won't be able to spend for social programs. And that way, the Republicans look like Santa Claus when they're spending and borrowing, and the Republicans look like Santa Claus when are preventing the Democrats from looking like Santa Claus. And they're doing that. And it's just, you know, I predicted that it would happen when Obama was elected, and they've been right on cue, right on down the line. Now, the trade deficit is a different thing. The trade deficit is a real problem for us because we're borrowing $600 billion a year from China to buy goods from China, which means that they end up, and it's not just China. I mean, it's China, it's Spain, it's Germany, it's France, it's every country all around the world. And this is why, I mean, here in Oregon, where I live, there's a new solar factory being built. They're going to hire, you know, short of 100 people. It's a big plant, but it's owned by the Spanish. There's a big windmill. It's owned by the Danish windmill factory. In Chicago, the Skyway, I believe, was bought by an Australian consortium. Why are these foreigners buying up America? Because every year we borrow $600 billion. We give them $600 billion. And the only place they can spend that is here in the United States at the end of the day. And so they have to buy us. And so what's happening is we're rapidly becoming a colonized third world country because of our insane trade policies, which takes us back, Bob, to where we started this conversation with George Washington.
And let's go back to our phone lines now to Bloomington, line 4. You're on the air with Tom Hartman.
Yeah, thank you. I listen to your program all the time and enjoy it so much.
Well, thank you. Or Tom, I guess you're talking about, not me.
Oh, yes, you, Bob.
Oh, okay.
And Tom, I've read some of your books, and I am so glad to hear you, and I was so disappointed Air America went off the radio. But
I'm still around.
Yeah, well, I hear that. I'm going to find you. But I just had a couple of questions. It's just wonderful to hear you. Thank you. Are you still living off the grid, and are you still vegan?
I'm still vegetarian, and I've never lived off the grid, although I came close to it at one point in my life. But
yeah,
right now,
one book you were going to, I didn't know.
Yeah,
if you,
yeah, it was. And Louise and I moved to Vermont. We bought that land that we talked about at the end of Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, and we got a couple of families together, and we built a couple of houses out in the woods, and some of them are still there, but I started a radio show in the midst of that just for the fun of it, and it turned into this monster that has consumed my life, and so,
yeah.
You know, here
yeah.
I am.
So, okay, and two others, we answer both or choose, but your comments on the New Yorker article about the Koch millionaires.
Yeah,
and then
the article speaks for itself.
So that's it.
Well, what's happening is that, you know, much of this, the populism and the anger and the fear of Americans is real because
Tom, let me for a second just back up for listeners who might not be familiar with the New York article on the Koch brothers.
Sure.
Just sum it up in a sentence or two. Mm-hmm. Could you just sum up what the article?
Oh, you want me to?
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah, basically what the article said was that the father of the current Koch brothers was one of the major funders of the John Birch Society back when it was JFK and LBJ, you know, one of these right-wing reactive groups against Democrats, liberals, and higher taxes, and that the sons now, David and Charles Koch, are funding groups like Freedom Works and whatnot to create these AstroTurf events that we call Tea Parties. And that the reason that they're doing this is because the government regulations that everybody's worried about, for them, that means don't regulate our oil industry because they're the largest domestic producer of oil, privately held domestic producer of oil products. And the, you know, cut our taxes means, you know, don't raise taxes on billionaires. So,
okay.
And the article's brilliant.
Yeah. May I ask my last question?
Yeah, please do. Go ahead.
Okay. I'm not clear. Is it free speech that allows these scare and lie tactics of the Limbaugh, Palin, and all that ilk? How is that still happening? Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Well, Tom Hartman, what's your response?
Well, Limbaugh and Beck and Hannity and all these guys on the right, one of the reasons why they're so high profile and one of the reasons why Murdoch was willing to lose $100 million a year for 5 years before Sean Hannity made his first penny on Fox News Air America in its entire lifespan only lost $17 million, why Murdoch was willing to lose $500 million, is because this is an investment. These very, very wealthy people are making an investment in right-wing media, and to the extent that right-wing media can keep Americans voting against their own best interests, the large corporations and rich fat cats are going to continue to make sure that Rush Limbaugh makes a $400 million paycheck and Sean Hannity a $200 million and Glenn Beck last year made $30 million. And they're going to have no interest in promoting programs like yours and mine, Bob.
You know, Tom, it's
got to do it ourselves.
It seems to me, though, that the Obama administration is just, and the whole political community in Washington, both parties, is way overly obsessed with Fox News and Glenn Beck and all the stuff. I mean, I teach for a living, and I'm in my classes, and I say, how many of you have ever watched Sean Hannity? And maybe one hand will go up or two hands. I mean, people under 40 or 35 in this country are completely oblivious to these announcers that Barack Obama seems obsessed with.
Well, most of the Tea Partiers, too, are baby boomers. You know, they're people in their 50s and 60s and 70s sometimes. Again, I think that the press fascination with this is it's the new shiny thing.
Mm-hmm.
There's large PR firms on the West Coast and on the East Coast that were documented in that New Yorker article and other places that you've written about that are pumping this stuff. And it's easy copy. And so many newsrooms have been so badly slashed that so many reporters are just so under the gun that you hand them an easy story, they run with it.
We've only got a minute or two left. We have one caller who's been waiting very patiently. Let's go to that call now. Line three, Urbana, you're on the air with Tom Hartman.
Yeah, I just wanted to quickly say that, kind of piggybacking on the Tea Party thing, I just had read that according to a recent poll by CBS New York Times that 75% of the people who identify with the Tea Party movement also support Social Security and Medicare. So I didn't know. I just feel like there must be some way to kind of connect with these people based on the fact that they're obviously making such a large – they're, you know, voting against their own interests. How can we, as a progressive, you know, movement, try to connect with these people based on that, if you have any ideas? Thanks.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Tom Hartman.
I've been encouraging people to go to Tea Party movements and shake hands and get to know people and try to find the areas of commonality. But frankly, I think that the person who needs most to be doing that and using the bully pulpit that he has to do that is President Obama.
You think he should head out to a Tea Party meeting?
No, I think that he should be speaking to those people. Not necessarily explicitly, but I think he needs to be calling out the fat cats behind the AstroTurf. He needs to be pointing out that it's AstroTurf. He needs to be calling this stuff out and he needs to help, you know, wake up Americans to the fact that they're being manipulated. I have Tea Party people in my family. I mean, these are well-intentioned people. They just don't have the facts.
Tom Hartman, we've only got about 30 seconds or a minute left. For the sake of our listeners, what do I do, Tom Hartman? How do I get involved? What steps should I take? I'm not used to this.
Well, there's two things.
Okay.
Very quickly. The first is that all political movements that have been successful and progressive in the last 250 years in this country have been small and local in their beginning. So I would say, you know, involve yourselves with your local groups, whether it's drinking liberally or the coffee parties or whatever. And then secondly, you got this giant multimillion-dollar enterprise, the Democratic Party, that's just sitting there wide open saying, hey, come on in, please, we need volunteers. We need to infiltrate it and take it over the same way the conservatives did with the Republican Party in the 70s. And I think that, you know, between those two things, between having an active, grassroots, mobilized populace and a takeover of the Democratic Party, we can move things forward. But it's going to require a hell of a lot of work by all of us, and despair is not an option.
That's the truth. Tom Hartman, thank you so much for joining us today in Media Matters. I hear the band tuning up in the background. That means they want to clear me out of the studio. It's been an honor having you on our program.
Thanks, Bob. It's been an honor being here. It's great talking with you.
Great. And I want to thank Melissa Trentz, my producer, Kyle Kroha, my engineer, for their hard work. I'm Bob McChesney, and I'll be back with all of you in 167 hours. Everyone have a great week.